Bow hunters are some of the hardest working hunters there are. Most of us work hard all year long just to get a couple weekends or burn our vacation time to sit in a tree. And just like the American blue collar worker, we're trying to balance work, family, faith, and a little time for ourselves in the great outdoors. Now let me introduce you to Trollco Clothing, a brand built by blue collar workers for blue collar workers. Workwear, comfortable tees, hoodies and hats for both men and women, Trollco represents the hardworking American. So whether you're operating heavy equipment, wrenching on engines, or in a factory living that shift life, Trollco has your back, literally. Head to trollco.com/hunting. That's trollco.com/hunting and enter the discount code Empire25 for 25% off of your first order. Trollco, for the hardworking American. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
5 a.m., I'm up with a crisp Celsius energy drink. Running 12 miles today. Grab a green juice, quick change, and head to work. Meetings, workshops, one more Celsius, no slowing down. Working late, but obviously still meeting the girls for a little dancing. Celsius, live, fit, go. Grab a cold, refreshing Celsius at your local retailer or locate now at Celsius.com.
Sierra has all the best active and outdoor brands you need, from athletic stuff, like a full court pickup game, swish, to athletic-ish stuff, like a half-mile stroll. Get those steps in! And for morning hikes up the mountain trail, good pace! To nighttime ghost stories from the camping chair. What a twist! Whatever level of active, Sierra loves it all. Head to Sierra or Sierra.com for the brands you want at the prices that let you do it all. From athletic to athletic-ish, Sierra's got it.
Spring break isn't what it used to be. It's better. This spring, stay 3 nights and get a $50 Best Western gift card. Life's a trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Visit bestwestern.com for complete terms and conditions.
This episode is brought to you by Peloton. Break through the busiest time of year with the brand new Peloton Cross Training Tread Plus. Powered by Peloton IQ. With real-time guidance and endless ways to move, you can personalize your workouts and train with confidence, helping you reach your goals in less time. Let yourself run, lift, sculpt, push, and go. Explore the new Peloton Cross Training Tread Plus at onepeloton.com.
You're listening to the Antler Up Podcast, where we dive into archery, hunting, and the mindset needed to elevate your game. Join us as we explore the latest strategies and gear to help you become the best hunter you can be, both in and out of the woods. What's up, everybody? Welcome back to this week's episode of the Antler Up Podcast. We're on episode 246, and this episode is brought to you by Tethered, the world's best saddle hunting gear. All right, everybody. So this week, I was joined by Lindsay Thomas Jr., Chief Communications Officer for the National Deer Association, and we get into some science of deer behavior, vision, and management. With 30 years of experience in deer management, Lindsay really shares his wealth of knowledge on how habitat and hunting pressure shape deer behavior. The conversation explores the crucial role of habitat management in maintaining healthy deer populations and how hunters can use signs of overbrowsing to assess the quality of the woods that we hunt in. Additionally, Lindsay explains how understanding deer vision and communication through scent vocalizations can dramatically improve hunting strategies, especially when managing hunting pressure. We also discuss really the impact of technology on hunting and deer research, because things have evolved so much over the 30 years that Lindsay has been involved in it. And between the GPS technology, for example, that has revolutionized the understanding of deer movement and has provided insights that benefit both us as hunters and also conservation efforts. Lindsay reveals some surprising data, such as how Thursdays are prime days for buck movement on public land. The episode wraps up with a conversation about the NDA's mission of education and advocacy, also as they continue to lead efforts in deer management and the future of hunting. So whether you're a seasoned hunter or just starting out, I hope you find this episode packed with insights that will help you be a better hunter and enjoy it here than the rest of this month of October. Get some tidbits from Lindsay for how maybe you want to attack things. This past weekend, opening day here in Pennsylvania, we were packed with action. Me and the boys got together to do our inaugural Antler Up camp. Had a blast doing that as well. Missing a couple people on that one, so looking forward to getting everybody back together here soon for that. But yeah, it was awesome. Had a great time, and I hope you had a great, fun day. And before we get into this week's episode, real quick, just want to talk to you about a brand new platform from Tethered, and that is the Predator V platform. I used it this past weekend, and I loved it. The slanted front had the new design on that, which was pretty awesome. I tended to, just because I'm not in saddle shape at the moment, I actually did seem to lean more, and I did appreciate that slanted front. So it comes in at just 3.4 pounds. It's still built with the die-cast aluminum. It features that patented traction tread on top for the grip is awesome on for any weather. And again, like I said, that angle front edge just adds comfort. And also there's a new leveling knob on it, which I really liked. It works super smooth. And then also the roller cam. I used a damn rope earlier in the day and I wanted to test out in the evening sit. I wanted to swap that out for the roller cam, which I really like both. You can't go wrong with either one. So this platform is built for stability and comfort. Get your Predator V over at tethered.com. At Antler Up, we know that quality gear can make or break your hunt, and that's why we're excited to partner with Huntworth Gear. If you're looking for premium gear without the premium price tag, Huntworth has you covered. And new for 2024, the Vertec pattern is a dynamic woodland camo pattern blending perfectly into any environment, whether you're stalking in the early season or hunkering down in the late season. From lightweight options for those warm September days to insulated gear that will keep you warm during the harshest winter conditions, Huntworth has you covered for everything you need all year long. Gear up right now and head over to huntworthgear.com to check out their full lineup.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the show. I'm joined by Chief Communications Officer for the NDA. I got Lindsay Thomas Jr. Lindsay, welcome to the show.
Hey Jeremy, thank you so much for having me.
Oh, anytime, man. I'm thrilled to have you on today's show. I mean, we'll talk some whitetail and, you know, we're getting to the beginning of the season here in the state of Pennsylvania, which is really exciting. A lot of states across the nation are obviously opened up, doing some early season stuff. Even parts of Pennsylvania have already opened up. So deer are already hitting the ground and, you know, people are learning and trying new things already this year. So it's exciting time. And I'm excited to talk some whitetails with you. Like you and I had the chance to talk last week, and I told you you were one name on my list that I've been dying to have on the podcast just to get your expertise, just because of you've been around the game for so long with it, and you gave me your history of the writing that you've done for so long. And again, I really like what you put out as far as on social media goes. It's a lot of, you know, I don't want to say concrete, but it's just very like you've done it, you've seen it, and you're trying to help others with that. And I respect that so much. So I'm really looking forward to this one and a long-winded introduction for you.
Well, I'm glad to be here. You know, I would say science-based is kind of what I put out there. I'm a journalist by training. And so I've spent my career learning from the scientists that are doing the work on this, the experts, and taking what I learned from them, communicating them to my audiences. So, you know, in terms of categorizing the type of information I like to put out, I think that's what I would say is science-based.
Yeah. Well, that's the aspect of things too. Like for me personally, I find very hard, I don't want to say very hard, but just in this world that we live in, as far as the social media side of things and having this platform, I mean, it'll be coming up to 5 years for me this January. And up until that point, Lindsay, to be completely honest with you, I think I've only missed 1 week, and it was early on in those stages. So having been that consecutive and finding relatable guests and people that could come on and tell a story or come on and give scientific information, it's kind of hard. So it's nice. These are the breath of fresh air type of episodes. I love to talk to individuals like yourself, and they come far few and between, because like you and I discussed last week when we chatted on last time, and we said, you know, a lot of these individuals that are maybe doing research, they can't really disclose a lot of information and all that type of stuff. So, you know, like you said, you're a journalist, and you know, we'll be able to get some more scientific things that you've, you know, seen done or that have already information that's been out there. So I'm looking forward to it. And I just think too, the way you explain things. So like, I want to go back to what I was saying earlier about the information you put out. For me, I could really consume that. I think you explain it exceptionally well. So that's why I'm thrilled to have you on and get into some whitetail specific things.
Great. Well, I'm so glad to be here. I'm happy to talk deer any day of the year, but right now things are really keyed up out there in the whitetail world. So
where are you at right now as far as the hunting season goes, Lindsay? Just because, like I said, PA, we're just kicking off and everything along those lines. I know you're more down south. So where are you at currently?
I live in Georgia, and our archery season opened September 14th. So we're in a little over a week now. Had two weekends. I did get to hunt opening weekend. Did not get to hunt this past weekend. I live 4 hours from my family's land, so I kind of have to pick and choose my trips. But I wanted to be there for opening weekend and I had a good time then. Probably going to go back either this weekend or the next. But a lot of times it's the weather. Right now we've got a hurricane bearing down on the southeast that's probably going to hit South Georgia through the weekend, Thursday, Friday, and into the weekend. So that may affect my travel plans. But yeah, we're already a week in. And Georgia has a pretty long season as far as the country goes. We'll go, gun season will come in around October 20th or so and run all the way through mid-January.
Gotcha. So let me ask you this, Lindsay. How long have you been doing writing when it comes to the outdoor world side of things, especially like whitetail? How many years of experience do you have under your belt?
Career-wise, I've been doing this 30 years. Wow. I was with Georgia Outdoor News Magazine as an editor there for 9 years, and I've been with this organization, the National Deer Association, for 21 years now.
That's awesome. And a lot of changes have come and gone through, I'm sure, during that time. So you've seen so much. So like with 30 years of experience, what is the one biggest interest you have when it comes to whitetails?
My biggest interest personally, I mean, is, I guess you can sum it up with the term management, managing deer populations, managing their habitat. I really love the habitat work, but getting to know a population inside and out in terms of things like buck to doe ratio and age structure and, you know, tinkering with that age of deer that we harvest and their health and how our habitat manipulation affects that. So that's kind of always been my personal interest. You know, when you look across hunting, everybody's got something they really are passionate about. You know, in the hunting world, it might be deer, it might be ducks, it might be small game, turkeys, whatever it is. Everybody's got kind of a passion. And then you look at deer and break it down further, and you got folks that are really into, say, archery and shooting their bow. Folks that really know firearms inside and out and shoot a lot and, you know, that sort of thing. So for me, it's the habitat and the deer population itself. That's kind of my passion.
Nice. Yeah, there's so much to learn with that too. I feel like that's one of those worlds of there's so many different aspects to it. Like you were saying, the habitat management, the herd management, as far as that goes, because I know too, I forget where I just saw it, but even Kip Adams obviously works for the NDA. I've had Kip on twice on the podcast over the last couple of years. And again, a wealth of knowledge from here of the state of Pennsylvania. And he, you know, the one question that he was answering on his social media was, you know, how do you know when like that buck to doe ratio, or when is it safe to, quote unquote, safe to take a doe and along those lines. So what have you learned through your, you know, world of studies when it comes to the management side of things, as far as like when to take doe, just because like for myself, you know, as a teacher, sometimes it's hard for me to, depending on how many chances I get. So like I try to maximize my opportunities. Like I have some private that I'm able to hunt. And I wouldn't say, I don't even have the opportunity to really manage those private lands. It's just you have access to hunt that. And so to go along with that, it's just, if an awesome opportunity comes up forward and I have a shot opportunity, I'm taking it. It just seems like everywhere that I've been right now and noticing what the deer herd has been like, our numbers are strong. So obviously I feel comfortable enough to take a doe early season. So do you map that out as far as like, hey, certain properties, or what's a good rule of thumb that as a hunter we could look at as far as when to take doe, when not to take a doe?
I tell you the thing that for me that I've learned over the years is looking at the habitat, having a feel for that, because, you know, once I hunt a place, I like to get to know the plant communities that are out there. Mm-hmm. Not only the trees, but the understory plants that deer browse and bed in, and get a feel for that. What are the native species that are there? What are the invasive species that are there as well? Because in habitat management, you're trying to control those, but a feel for what are the native plants there that are the key deer forages, ones they're going to prefer the most. And it varies a lot regionally, but also there's some species that are just going to be, you know, highly preferred deer forages in a lot of regions. So once you learn those and just doing even a quick drive through or walk through of a hunting property, you develop an eye for seeing that either those high quality, most preferred species are just overbrowsed or gone, or they're abundant. Or you see, for example, the lowest quality species being browsed. When you see little signs like that, that quickly tunes you in to, can quickly tune you into kind of where the deer population and density is relative to the amount of forage. You can either see right off fairly quickly that you're in a situation that's got abundant forage and of quality species, therefore it's not overbrowsed. You're not in a situation that's got more deer than food, you know, or you see those warning signs that says more deer than food. So real quick, you can get a feel once you have, you know, knowledge of the plant species that are out there and how deer use them for where deer are in that spectrum of too many deer to too few deer or just about right.
Yeah. What can we do? I mean, in all reality, what can we do as hunters or landowners to support that better habitat management to meet the wildlife, you know, obviously deer, whitetail specific, but like other animals along those lines to meet their needs? What can we really do for them?
So for deer and a lot of other species, a lot of it has to do with just getting sunlight on the ground and growing early successional cover, growing young, what we often refer to as young forest cover. You know, if you're in a situation where you're looking at mature hardwood forests or any other mature type of forest that's older trees that are shaded out, canopied out, and, you know, it seems park-like underneath there, to people that often seems nice. Oh, I can walk here. I can see a long way. That's not great for deer. Deer need plants that they can reach, that they can bed in, that they can forage on at ground level. And so many times just producing that, maintaining that, any block of cover, any block of forest is aging before our eyes as we're looking at it. Every minute of every day of every year, it's aging as long as you're not doing something to stop that. And so shrubs are growing, you know, becoming tree saplings are becoming mature trees, and shade is increasing. And as shade increases, the quality of that habitat for deer decreases. So anything you can do to rewind the clock on that and continue to offer areas that are younger, that have good sunlight and a lot of forage for deer is not only going to be good for deer, but there are a ton of species that, you know, game and non-game that benefit from that young forest and that early successional cover, everything from turkeys to pollinators.
Yeah. So let me ask you this, just maybe you rattled off some things there, but to kind of even, you could either elaborate maybe a little bit more, or if that's the main key, you know, when it comes to either food shortage or habitat loss, you know, what are those signs of that we see that are really stressing the whitetail? You know, like you were saying, you know, when there's too much shade or things along those lines, what are some of those signs that we should really take notice? Like, hey, we should really maybe think about doing some work here. I mean, that, to be completely honest with you, here in Northeast Pennsylvania, where I hunt and hunt private, Lindsay, it's a very big mountain, big woods area. Years and years and years ago, I mean, I'm 37. I was in high school, I believe, when they did this one little section of a clear cut burn. And it's, you know, it's very rocky, and it did great for some whitetail, did awesome for turkey. I remember those high school years of just turkey being everywhere up there. But since then, it's been small things when it comes to land management. Like I said, there's no food plots. It's big woods. So like, what are some signs that my dad and I could look at, maybe bring to the individual and say, hey, like, you know, this might be something that we need to look at when it comes to, could be shortage or habitat improvements to help these whitetail and other species.
So signs that there's an issue that you could point to would be things like a browse line in the woods where deer have eaten everything that they can reach down mm-hmm. to the ground. You know, if you can walk through woods or the edges of woods and the browse line is evident, you can see it like a clear demarcation. That's a sign deer don't have enough food. And many times they'll be damaging things. They'll be preventing oak regeneration, for example, because they're eating all the oak seedlings that managed to sprout. So they can impact forest regeneration in that sense. You'll see them browsing things that deer don't, you know, shouldn't want to eat. So, you know, conifer needles and invasive plants. The presence of invasive and non-native plants, mm-hmm. too, can be an indicator in its own right of a habitat situation that's out of balance, because most non-native and invasive plants deer do not eat. They're eating the native forages that they prefer, so these native plants are fighting against deer and fighting against the non-natives for space. So they've kind of, you know, taken a double whammy. Meanwhile, these non-natives are proliferating and nobody's bothering them. So if right. non-native plants are widespread and common in an area, again, that can be a sign that deer have overbrowsed the native plants and allowed non-native plants to take over. So removing non-native plants is just yeah. as good as restoring sunlight in an open field or thinning some timber to get sunlight back on the ground, you know, opening a food plot. Removing a non-native plant in those cases, again, make space for those native plants that deer use. So those are some of the signs you can point to that show in an out of balance situation that deer are having negative impacts on the landscape.
Yeah, that's excellent information there, Lindsay. And so to kind of keep it along the lines of land and along those, along this, can you recall like a really unique hunt where it was outside your comfort zone or in a unique state or type of something that you just weren't used to, accustomed to when it came to whitetail hunting? What was that hunt and where was that located?
That's an interesting one. Trying to think. You know, here in Georgia, I hunt from time to time when I can get drawn. I'll hunt public land on our coastal islands here in Georgia. We have a number of barrier islands on the Georgia coast, and surprisingly, most of them are undeveloped. Most of them are public land, either federal land or state-owned. And there are some public hunting opportunities on those islands. They're undeveloped. You know, there's no bridges that go over there. Very, very remote. So that's probably one of the most unique situations I've ever been in. You know, you're going over there, you're camping. You're not managing the habitat over there. You don't know right. the woods well, and there are these deep, deep woods that are remote. And it's, yeah, that's probably the most challenging and unique situation that I deal with when it comes to deer hunting, because you've got a short time. It's a quota hunt. You're camping. You don't have much time to get to know the woods and get to know the deer. You're also sort of, you know, not necessarily competing against the other hunters, but there's other hunters on the island, you know, trying to take some venison home on a short hunt as well. So that's probably the most unique situation similar to what you're asking that I can think of.
Yeah, that sounds really cool. There's a buddy of mine, very similar, hunts Michigan, and there's a place kind of that's, he's speaking to what you just said. There's like an island and there's deer there. Like it's a unique hunt where I think he even said you have to take like a ferry in, which is kind of cool. You know what I mean? Like you gotta, you know, it's not, there's no easy way to get there. So yeah, that does seem some challenging situations for you for sure. So I asked you like what your, one of your main interests are is, and my interest really comes down to communication. Like I don't have a lot of cell cameras out, and I like to do a lot of SD cameras where I let them soak in certain locations. I really like to have the opportunity to have them run on video just to learn for years to come. And that's like a lot of those, especially I would say 97% of those are for years to come and not necessarily for information right now. So when that comes to, for me, when it comes to deer communication, Lindsay, what's your take on that as far as, because obviously we know they heavily rely on scent communications like for scrapes and things along those lines. So, you know, what is your take on when it comes to that? Are you interested in that type of stuff? And, you know, maybe even the vocalization side of things, as far as deer communications, what's the things that you've learned over the years that could really help some whitetail hunters, especially now during bow season?
Yeah. So, I do get into that, all of the types of communication that they use. You know, when you do what we do, and you're taking the right number of does, you're not harvesting yearling bucks, you're trying to let bucks get a little bit of age on them, and you're balancing that buck to doe ratio, you get to hear that a lot more. You get to see a lot more of the rut interactions that mm-hmm. don't happen and aren't as intense when, you know, you've got an area that buck harvest pressure is high and nobody's taking any does. So, and deer health is not necessarily as good either. So, you get to hear more vocalizations. You get to see more rut activity. Things like grunt calls and rattling antlers work better. So there's that. But I think scent communication is probably, you know, the world that whitetails live in more than anything else. Whether that is scent on the ground where other deer have walked, but especially around scrapes, you know, leaving scent on the licking limb, leaving it in the scrape itself. I love watching that through my trail cameras. Just yesterday, I got a picture of a doe working a scrape, and you don't see that very often. It happens. Does do work scrapes. But you just don't often get that picture of a doe, you know, leaning her head up to lick the licking limb while she's standing in a scrape. You know, you see bucks do that. But so, yeah, that's a part that interests me, especially when it comes to like my own hunting pressure. Because we understand how important scent is to deer, not only in communicating with each other, but, you know, defending themselves against predators. So my own scent, how I realize places I walk, deer are going to know that. Deer are going to know I've been there. And that's pretty much unavoidable. Now, you can certainly reduce your scent, but you never fully eliminate it. So, you know, deer are going to know where I've been, especially if they're downwind of me. So, you know, using that knowledge, knowing that they live in a world of scent we can't even imagine, that they, you know, quote, see a world through scent that we cannot see, is an amazing fact to me about deer. And it impacts everything about how we manage and hunt them from a pressure standpoint, but also understanding how they're communicating with each other about where they are in the breeding cycle and where they are geographically.
Yeah. That's the one aspect that you brought up about pressure when it comes to calls and everything along those lines. And the one call that I have seemed to have a lot of success with, it doesn't matter the time of year. It could be September in an out-of-state hunt in Maryland. It could be early October, the rut. The one call that it just sometimes to me seems bullet, I don't want to say bulletproof, but one that I have more success getting a deer to come in is a snort wheeze. I won't ever forget. Like I was doing it from a couple years ago obviously during that late October, during the rut, and it's like, wow, like I got that deer to literally turn on a dime and come to me. Like there, you know, if I would have rattled, that deer would have maybe not have cared if I would have grunted, because I've had that happen. And it just seems like 7 out of 10 times, a good 70% of the time, when if I do a snort wheeze, that deer's coming in at least in some form of fashion, like even if he holds up or something along those lines. And last season in the state of Maryland, early season, it got done raining. I was set up over a scrape and it was my last night there. I didn't know if I was going to go back in some other time of the season. I was like, you know what? Rain just stopped. There's a scrape here. I'm downwind of it. There's a nice little thicket where this trail's coming out of. Let's give a little blind snort wheeze. Like I did it blindly. And I was fixated on this one area that I could have swore, because of the way the wind was blowing, a deer would come out of. And lo and behold, he came out of my whole other direction where I came from, actually, which shocked me. And he was a beautiful buck. And it just, it happened so fast that he was already underneath me with the canopy, and I just didn't have time. And he saw me and he busted out of there. And then, you know, I've had other friends that are extremely great hunters that just even recently this season, same thing, kind of snort wheeze came in and just held up and didn't get that shot opportunity. And it's just like, dude, we're in the month of September. Like we're not, is it because their pressure's not on yet? Or is the snort wheeze like the king of calls that not a lot of people talk about?
I've never heard one, you know, in the wild, and it's a pretty rare call from what I understand. I had an interesting conversation the other day with Tess Jolly, who's a wildlife photographer from Alabama. And we were talking about all the behaviors she's witnessed over the years, being privileged to photograph deer in a situation where they're not being hunted. And she's kind of in there among them, spending all day getting photography, and being lucky over all the years that she's done this to be very close to some situations where bucks are tending does, you know, kind of the prime moment there. And she told me something interesting. She told me that the most of the times that she has heard a grunt snort wheeze is when a buck is tending a doe, she's bedded down, he's just hanging around nearby waiting, which is a lot of what tending is, a buck waiting for this doe to finally become receptive. And he's sort of gotten tired of waiting. He's standing up, walking over to where she's bedding, and will do the snort wheeze and stomp the ground. And Tess believes it's a way of him saying, okay, get up. I'm losing patience. That's the situation where she has heard it more often than not. So we often hear that the snort wheeze is an aggressive call between two bucks, and I think it can be. But to hear Tess say that was interesting to me. And it, you know, either way, like you said, it's worked out to be a call that was effective at bringing bucks in, and you can see it either way. If it means that a buck is tending a doe, and that's what that call means, mm-hmm. It's, you know, incumbent upon other bucks to come in there and check that situation out, regardless whether it's a buck fight or whether either way, it suggests that there's a estrus doe in the area and they need to go in there and check it out. So,
to kind of build upon even the snort wheeze, I've had more success with like a doe bleat call than I have another grunt call or rattling antlers. I tell this story from my hunt last year with, you know, the state of Ohio. It was getting down to dark and I saw a deer walking across this hillside and I was waiting for my buddy to come out and I couldn't see. I just saw eyes with my headlamp basically. And I just went, meh. And I just went, gave a snort wheeze, and that sucker came right down to one of the biggest bucks I've ever seen on hoof. And it was like, it was just so unique because I literally gave probably the worst snort wheeze, the worst kind of grunt, you know, call sound. But this buck, he came in and he postured up about 12 yards from me. And I just turned on my headlamp and I put my head down and he just walked off. He didn't even spook or anything like that. He walked off. And when I got eyes on him, I was just like, oh my gosh, the giants do actually exist, basically, coming from, you know, where kind of the deer I've always had encounters with. But it was definitely fascinating. And like I said, the communication side of thing always interests me. And I love when some of my good friends send me videos of the way bucks hit scrapes. Like I find it unique. Like for example, the one cell camera that I do have up and running, I had a doe just yesterday. So we're talking September 22nd on a Sunday. I had a doe on top walking across. And then all of a sudden, when I got the video sent to me, all I hear is ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch, and come flying downwind was this buck. And he just hits that licking branch. And then the next video of him hitting the licking branch, because I only do small segments of seconds, he was aggressively just tearing up that licking branch. I mean, he was fired up, and it was unique to see. And I was just like, man, something about it, I love it. I just absolutely love the way to see deer communicate and learn from it. So here's what I want to ask you, Lindsay. So kind of moving on from the communication side of things, tell me about you made that video of the deer vision and senses. You know, you talked about like the shape of their eyes, you know, to kind of build upon that, how does the color spectrum that deer see impact the way we should think about, you know, as far as, you know, our gear that we use or anything along those lines, how that color spectrum, like, so how does that impact us?
So the science that's been done on that, and a lot of that was done actually here in Georgia at the University of Georgia Deer Lab, a number of studies over the years looking at deer eyes and basically examining things like how many rods, how many cones do they have, and in what array, what percentage compared to our vision and compared to, you know, other things we know about vision. And what they've determined is that deer see in a slightly different color range than we do. They perceive color. It's not black and white, but they perceive blue in the blue end of the spectrum far better than we do, about 20 times better than we perceive blue. But that's to the detriment of the red-orange end of the spectrum. So we suspect that red-orange looks more like a gray-brown to them. And so, you know, your orange vest as a color is not going to jump out to them, but something that's blue most likely would stand out to them. And it's interesting because that's, when I think about it, it's similar, not the same, but similar to someone who has a red-green color deficiency in their vision. And I actually have that. Okay. I'm not colorblind, but for me, reds don't pop, particularly when they're against greens and browns, other colors in that same end of the spectrum. Now, I know what red is, and when I see something red, I know I'm looking at red. But say, for example, blood trailing is probably the best example. Someone with normal color vision could be walking along and looking on the ground and saying, oh, there's blood, and seeing it easily. Whereas me, I'm probably going to have to get down on my hands and knees and get closer, and then I'll see it. Oh, okay, yeah, I got you. It doesn't jump out to me. So interestingly enough, I think that my vision is probably similar to a deer's, but though not quite the same. Blues also pop to me. When I'm like using flagging tape in the woods to mark something, mm-hmm. I always buy blue flagging tape, not orange, because blue really stands out to me in the woods where orange doesn't. Again, I still see orange. I just right. don't see it as well against the backgrounds of certain colors. So that's similar to what deer see, though I'm sure their color vision is worse even than mine. And when it comes to reds and oranges, they just don't perceive red as red the way we do.
So that's all great information. And maybe for the people that don't have social media, that did not get a chance to see that video that you were talking about, as far as like the shape of the deer's eyes, do you want to go over that briefly? Just because I found that fascinating. Again, once I saw that video, that's when I was like, I got to get Lindsay on. This is it. I got to message him and get this going. So maybe you can explain that, just because, again, that's such good information.
Yeah. And it's pretty simple. And if anybody who owns horses or goats or something like that can see what we're talking about here, but deer have a horizontal or slot shaped pupil, like goats do and horses and a few other hoofed mammals. And their eyes are situated on the side of not, you know, completely laterally on the side of their head, but sort of, you know, partially on the sides of their head. And when you consider those horizontal slot pupils and the position of the eyes on the head, what that gives them is an enormous horizontal band of vision going all the way around, except for about 60 degrees in the back of their head. And what that allows them to do is see motion along the horizon very well. Deer don't have great focal acuity. They're not very sharp in terms of their visual acuity. And they're, because their eyes are not, they don't have a large overlap, what's called binocular vision, like we do in the front. You know, we can focus in on things. They can't. Their eyes are really designed to give them the broadest potential field of zone that will detect motion. That's their number one way of avoiding danger, is to detect something moving toward them or moving near them as soon as possible. So that's what their eyes are designed to do. And what, you know, what I pointed out in this video the other day was something that I saw some research done by the University of California at Berkeley, looking at the eyes of ungulates and hoofed mammals like this. And they talked about something called cyclovergence. And what that means is that a deer's eyes can spin independently in opposite directions when a deer lowers its head. So it's almost kind of a gimbal that keeps the deer's eyes and those horizontal pupils keeps them parallel to the horizon, no matter what angle the deer holds its head. So as they tilt their head down, the eyes rotate in opposite directions to maintain that visual field covering the horizon. And the take-home point for a hunter is when their nose is down on the ground picking up a persimmon or a crabapple or an acorn, they can still see motion around them just as well. They're still monitoring their surroundings just as well as when their head is up. You know, some people think, wait till they put their head down and then draw your bow. But if you can see the deer's eye, there's a very good chance it's going to detect the motion of you drawing that bow. And so knowing that, you know, tells you, you probably should wait till you can get the deer's head behind a tree or behind some brush, or it's looking directly away from you in some way you can't see either one of its eyes when you're at close range. Because the other thing we know about deer vision, again, from some University of Georgia work, is that deer process visual imagery more rapidly than we do. And what that means is they pick up motion faster than we do. So again, going back to the fact that detecting motion, detecting the presence of a predator at close proximity is one of the most important things for a deer to be able to do. That's what they can do. They're very good at detecting motion in a broad visual area. So again, be careful when you draw your bow. Pay careful attention to the deer's eyes, because when their head's down, it doesn't necessarily mean they can't see you.
Yeah. So to kind of even build upon that, obviously it's something different. And it's the, I guess the, one of the questions that's a, you know, gets asked a lot, but like for me personally, I'm not a big fan of stopping deer by making a noise. And it just seemed like every time I do that, it's the deer either just runs off or whatever. I always try to pick my spots. I'm not saying that I like to shoot a walking deer, but any chance that I could really let that deer stop on its own and then take my shot, that's what I'm doing. Is there anything that you've learned or understand as far as that goes? I mean, obviously deer behavior is all different and everything along those lines, but where do you stand on that line?
Well, the thing about deer hearing is they're very good at pinpointing the locations of sounds. You know, we know they've got fairly large ears. You know, you've seen them use them like sonar, radar dishes. But the interesting thing about deer's ears is, you know, they can move them in different directions. They can pivot one forward, and then you'll see them sometimes turn the other ear literally to cup behind them at covering two different directions at one time. And the reason for that, when you can do that, if we could do that, if our ears were that large and we could move them independently like that, we would be even better at pinpointing the locations of the source, the origin source of any sound.
Right.
So that's the danger in making a sound yourself is, you know, I think, and you watch videos of people doing this when they're hunting. My opinion is you better be drawn, you better be aiming, you better be ready to release that arrow or pull the trigger as soon as the deer stops. You're not going to make a noise like that and then have the deer stand around and wonder what's going on. They're going to pinpoint your location pretty quickly when you do that, particularly if you make more than one sound. So they're good at pinpointing location with sound. So you got to be careful doing that.
Yeah. So like right now we're, like I said, we're towards the end of September here in Pennsylvania. If not all, every single whitetail buck has shed his velvet. And with that, some behavioral biological standpoint has changed for them. I mean, I guess I could go out on a limb and say that. And, you know, like with that, obviously some behavior changes, you know, physiologically and, you know, they prepare for the, what's to like to come up. And what are some other, I mean, obviously other than the rut, what other changes happens that you could really speak upon for about these whitetail, like this time of year? Because I feel like this is the time of year where a lot, if any point in time throughout the year, has the most impact and change for a whitetail.
Movement is the big one. Bucks are expanding their movement. Now that's rut related. So yeah, you know, you're right. The rut is bringing about a lot of changes, physiological changes. The testosterone is rising. Their necks are swelling. You know, does are getting ready to come into estrus. They're beginning to do the scrapes and the rubs and the things to increase the communication about what's going on out there relative to the breeding season. But movement is the big one. Bucks start expanding their movement, and they cover the greatest percentage of their home ranges during the pre-rut and the rut of any other time of year. Summer is the smallest percentage of a home range that they'll use. They contract their movements a good bit, and the rut's going to be the greatest. So, you know, bachelor groups breaking up and spreading apart from each other and bucks covering more ground, that's probably, you know, that's another big change is simply in movements. Bucks that you might have been seeing on camera or seeing with binoculars in summer, very likely to disappear at this point, you know, quote, disappear, and you don't know where they went because they're covering more ground and perhaps even changing to a different compartment of their home range for the rut. Some bucks do that. So, yeah, the movement change is the biggest one. You know, at this time of year, particularly in the rut, you may see bucks you've never had on camera before, didn't have them last year, didn't have them all summer, haven't seen them before now, and you might not see them again. So, yeah, the change up in location and movement is, you know, other than just the physiological changes of the rut, that's probably the biggest one.
So if you had a couple deer, I don't want to just pinhole you up against one deer here, Lindsay. You had a couple bucks that you would be more than happy to wrap your hands around their antlers. What would be your approach? Would you try to go in early season, or would you kind of hold out for an October hunt or a rut hunt? Like when, if you knew you had a chance at one of these three deer, let's say three, you had three amigos to potentially get after, which one are you, what type of season are you really going to try to put a little bit more effort into to get the job done?
Year in and year out for me, it's going to be the peak of breeding, wherever that is in the calendar. You know, for us in coastal Georgia, it's late October, first week of November. Halloween is kind of the peak for us. And so that's, to me, that is the best opportunity when you have a particular buck you're seeing on camera or your nose in the area. Your best chance of seeing him moving in daylight is during that period of time of year. End of story. They just don't move as much or as much in daylight as they do, you know, during the peak of breeding. And of course, we all know that during the peak of breeding, bucks are a little more, little less cautious as well. Sometimes, you know, if he's going to make a mistake, it's going to be during the rut because they're kind of got one thing on their mind. And they often will, they're not, you know, they don't lack caution, but they're less cautious than they normally would be. So those two things kind of are to your advantage. You know, the only time I would jump out there, say right now in the pre-rut, in the early season, and go after a particular buck is if I just had managed to get a camera in a core zone of where this buck is living and I'm seeing him every day and there's a pattern there of his location and time of day or, you know, some food resource he's coming to like a persimmon tree or whatever that is just looking really good and likely on my camera, I might go there to try to get that buck at that place and time. But I've never had that happen to me actually. So, yeah. For me, it is peak of breeding is when I'm, you know, going after a particular buck, just because that's the most likely time of year I am to see him.
Yeah. It's tough. That early season has become very difficult. I mean, this past year, it was October 23rd, whatever that Monday was, 22nd, 23rd. That was like one of the earliest bucks that I've had the chance to wrap my tag around, basically, as far as that goes in the state of PA. You know, I've killed opening day does, stuff like that, but no bucks. And I, you know, that was a really cool experience for me, and seeing how that goes. I mean, I've had a couple opportunities in years past where it would have been like the 18th, things along those lines, just because of the way my work schedule was a couple years ago. We would have like these in-service days, and so I would have some time to go out there, and there were a couple really nice deer two years in a row that I had missed opportunities on. But so like with that, I want to transition to a little bit as far as like talking a little bit about hunting pressure. And it could be private land, it could be public land. Obviously, when we get into the woods, when it finally happens, it's the season, depending on how much, you know, you get in there, and obviously your entry routes and exit routes all play a critical role in, you know, being, you know, like we were even saying earlier about our scent and everything, about how much pressure we could put on these deer. Especially for public land, Lindsay, because we don't know if we go out on a Saturday, we don't know who's going in out there the next day on a Sunday here in PA to scout. Obviously, there's only three weekends we could hunt here. But then who has that Monday off that's going in there that we don't know, and putting all the pressure in. So when you talk about how you were saying in early season, maybe having a deer on camera, and things change a little bit, right? Maybe there's a food source or that pressure. What specific signs should we look for to adjust like to these higher pressure areas? So like what things should we look at when we're like, man, other than the deer maybe not showing up as much? Cause it seems like more than ever this year, I've talked to more people that said, I don't have cameras out. So I feel like there's not going to be as much kind of like finger on that tab, basically, to say like on the pulse. So if those individuals that aren't running cameras, what kind of signs should we be looking at as far as, you know, understanding like there's a lot of pressure in this area?
Well, when it comes to pressure, you know, looking at human patterns is really the best thing to do. Understanding where the people are, whether it's where you've been, your hunting partners, or on a public land situation, just trying to anticipate where most of the pressure is going to be. You know, there's been a lot of studies done on public hunting land that showed that most of the pressure, of course, occurs fairly close to a public road, a road that is open to vehicle traffic, and that, you know, only a small percentage of public land hunters go further than about, you know, a quarter mile away from the nearest road. So finding an area that is remote many times on public land, or any area that's hunted heavily, mapping out an area that just is not being hit by hunters or seen, used by hunters, is probably going to point you to an area that'd be good to try, because we know from the studies of deer wearing GPS collars that they respond quickly to our pressure. They don't leave the area, but they change their movement locations and their movement times to avoid areas where we go. So, you know, it's simply, if you can find those empty spaces on the map where people aren't going, many times you're going to find deer there. And then two, not just in space, but in time as well. Auburn University did an interesting study a few years back where they had a lot of deer collared, GPS tracking collars on public and private land, looking at hunting pressure, looking at deer movements. And, you know, one of the things they noticed was that on public land in particular, the best day of the week to see bucks for overall movement, but especially daylight movement, was a Thursday.
I was just about to say Wednesday or Thursday.
Yeah, it was Thursday. And, you know, there's some other science. In this case, out of, Auburn as well, did this work as well in another location. Looking at the amount of time it takes for a deer stand to recover from hunting pressure in terms of bucks movement patterns to return to normal relative to that deer stand, they found it took 2 to 3 days before buck movements around a deer stand returned to normal after that stand was hunted. So think about that. You got people piling into public land on Saturday and Sunday. Well, Thursday is, you know, what? You got 3 days and then there's Thursday after a weekend. So that makes sense that they saw that Thursday was the best day of the week on public land for overall buck movement and especially daylight movement. It took them that long to recover from the surge of hunting pressure on that land. So again, space, where are people not going, but also time, when are people not there?
That's a lot too. And that's all really good information. And like you said, there's studies out there that we could all read and check out. And, you know, to kind of go off of that research too, Lindsay, before we wrap things up, you know, like you said earlier, 30 years in the game, so much has changed, so much has developed with the use of technology. You know, how do you see that continuing to shape deer research and management practices? And just because that's all benefiting not only us as hunters, but individuals that are managing the land, managing our species and along those lines. So how do you see that continuously shape as far as the research goes in the future?
Yeah, it has changed so much in my 30 years. You know, when I was starting out as a deer journalist, people were still putting radio tracking collars on deer where you had to go out and triangulate a deer's location. You know, you had to listen and use an antenna, get a beep that showed you a straight line to where the deer was located. Then you had to drive to another location and get a second location on it, and then a third, and then triangulate to pinpoint where the deer was on the map. Now we've got GPS collars, and their technology has improved greatly over years. You know, when GPS tracking collars first came out, you know, you might get a deer's location every few hours. Today, they're giving you a location on the deer, you know, every few minutes, 24 hours a day. They can tell you even that the deer has stopped moving, so it's possibly dead. I mean, we can, and the accuracy of the location too has improved. So the maps we're getting now on deer movements with these GPS tracking collars are just mind-blowing how good they are. You know, we're literally, Mississippi State University is literally studying bedding behaviors, looking at how often bucks bed in the same location and, you know, where they bed. So that technology has vastly improved. We've also now got DNA that we weren't able to examine 30 years ago that has taught us things about deer relationships, how many fawns a buck produces over his lifetime, things like antler genetics. You know, it's shown us again what we suspected, which is you can't manage deer genetics in wild deer. Those two things, GPS tracking collars and DNA, are probably the two biggest advances in technology in terms of what they've shown us about deer that we did not know 30 years ago.
Yeah, that's exciting. What about the NDA? What's the future initiatives that you are excited about as far as the NDA initiatives in the future?
So a lot of, you know, what we've always worked on that will, you know, probably never go away in terms of hunter recruitment, in terms of policy and advocacy, making sure that, you know, every year when legislatures meet and Congress meets, that good deer policy is being passed and bad deer policy is being stopped. You know, the education of deer hunters about habitat and deer management and deer biology and the new science we're learning is always ongoing. But then, you know, things change as well. 30 years ago, when I started work, I didn't know what chronic wasting disease was. And now that is a big factor in the future of deer and deer hunting. So it's something that we work on a lot. You know, doe harvest, believe it or not, we've come full circle. 30 years ago, this organization I worked for was trying to get deer hunters to learn about doe harvest and learn that they needed to take some does sometimes. Well, we succeeded there, came a long way. And then, in the last 5 years or so, trends have receded from that. We're going back toward harvesting more bucks nationally than does, and we're starting to see a trend again toward high density deer populations and inadequate doe harvest in some areas. So now we're shifting gears back to a message about doe harvest again, because it's time to harp on that again. So, you know, there are some new things, there's some old things that are never going away, there's some old things that went away and are going to come back. I guess, you know, we've got job security.
Yeah. Well, I'm absolutely. And man, even in the state of Pennsylvania, when you look at it, my unit where I currently live, we have that brand new extended firearm season when it comes to in January. That's brand new this year. So I don't know how I feel about it, you know, in the middle of January, you know, before for that extended archery season, basically was that in the flintlock. Now you got, you're able to take your rifle out and it's like, man, those deer are going to be heavily pressured this year. And I'm really anxious to see how that's going to turn out. You know, to kind of wrap it up, Lindsay, and I'm going to give you a couple of rapid fire questions. You could answer it, you know, in short one word or two, like a sentence or two answer. So when it comes to, I think I'm going to know this one because I kind of alluded to it earlier. Favorite deer hunting season, early, pre-rut, rut, or late season?
Anyone that's open.
You have the time, right? Anyone that's open and you have the time to hunt it. I like
that's
it.
That's right. I can't say that I have a favorite. I love them all. If season's open, I'm going. I'm going to bow hunt with the mosquitoes early season. I'm going to hunt the rut. I'm going to be there till the season closes and it's cold and dark, you know, late in the year. So I honestly don't think I have a favorite.
I like it. What's the one piece of gear you never leave home without during the season?
A thermocell.
Down in Georgia, I could see that.
Yeah, coastal Georgia.
Because hunting Maryland last year and Delaware a couple of years ago, I was like, oh my gosh, this is the greatest invention of all time when it comes to mosquitoes.
Yeah. I mean, you know, in coastal Georgia, we can get warm days, warm spells, and warm afternoons in December and even into January. And you just never know. You think, mm-hmm. Oh, it's December, January. I'm glad the mosquitoes are gone. And then, you know, a warm afternoon hits and they appear. So in coastal Georgia, I never hunt without a thermocell.
Yep. If you could hunt one state or region for the rest of your life, where would it be?
South Georgia.
I like it. Homebody. I like it. Last question.
I know that sounds like an introvert or something, but it's the land I know. It's the habitat I know. It's the woods I know. And the deer I know is land I'm from. So it's just, that's where my heart is. It's where I love to hunt.
I like it. What's, do you think the state of Pennsylvania? So I know you're down south, but I know you have some friends up here and everything like that. Will we finally see in the future within 5 years, let's go 5 years. Will we see Sunday hunting throughout the season?
Can I phone a friend? Need to ask Kip on that one. I thought y'all passed Sunday hunting.
Well, we have 3 days. It's getting there. We're getting closer. We're getting very close. It's like the last, I don't know, to be honest with you, I'm horrible with it. I think we have one more major big vote where it needs to go. And if it gets approved, then I think we're golden. So I keep telling people, I think it could be next year. I think it could be the 25-26 season. Fingers crossed. You have no idea as far as being an educator, how much I would absolutely appreciate that. I know.
I bet. And I mean, that's the factor behind this. It's why we support allowing Sunday hunting is because of opportunity. Chances for folks to get in the woods, you know, more than they normally could if you can't hunt Sundays. A lot of these laws date way back. They go back to a time when people were trying to minimize pressure on deer and still allow people to hunt them because populations were thin and stretched and, you know, shaky and they wanted to restore deer. Those days are gone. There's no biological reason to maintain Sunday hunting, not from the deer population standpoint, and so many positive social reasons to open that opportunity up to new hunters, you know, old hunters, young hunters, everyone. So yeah, we're fully in favor of Sunday hunting and glad to see the trends in recent years going toward, you know, the end of those laws.
Yeah. And again, I'm not sitting here, you know, debating the whole, when should our rifle season open? Should it not open on a Saturday anymore? And go back to a Monday hunting, all that type of stuff. But it's just, you know, not everybody grew up in a camp and it's, I love the tradition. I love hearing people's story about it and I'm all for that. I think you could, you know, go, you could still do that in a different way maybe, but yeah, I just, as far as it goes with my line of work, I need that Sunday, you know, I shouldn't say I need it. It's just, it would be so welcomed just because you're limited on your time. as far as during the week goes and all that type of stuff. So I would appreciate it. I'm sure a lot of other people would as well. Lindsay, I can't thank you enough. It was an honor to have you on to speak with you. I hope you stay in touch. And where could people listen to you, follow along, see what the NDA is up to? Just because you have a lot of initiatives, you have a lot of branches. So where can people maybe look in to help out and look at more information?
Go to deerassociation.com. That's our website. And I'd urge everybody to click that join button. There's a free basic membership. Doesn't cost you anything. Sign up to be a free basic member. You'll receive our weekly e-newsletter that goes out every Thursday morning. Got great deer information in it. Keep you up to date on our events and our mission work. That's the best way to start engaging. On social media, we're at Deer Association is our handle on everything. Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, YouTube. So look us up at Deer Association.
Awesome, Lindsay. Thank you so much for your time and your wisdom and your knowledge, everything. Thanks again, everybody, for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed this one. We'll see you next week. Antler up.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Antler Up podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. Please go check us out on our Instagram, YouTube, Facebook, and Go Wild, and at antlerupoutdoors.com. If you enjoyed this episode, go leave a review and subscribe for next week's episode. Until then, Antler Up.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.